Hello, podcast listeners. This is Pastor Jen. Every once in a while, the very ancient technology at Central Baptist Church decides not to function. And last Sunday was one of those Sundays. When that happens, I usually end up needing to reproduce the sermon that I gave already because it's usually part of a larger whole, as you know, a larger sermon series, and contributes to the whole. So that's what I'm doing tonight. I'm actually giving this sermon for the second time in my living room. If you hear any extraneous sound, it's likely to be the dog and his collar. But I will present this to you, and I hope that you will find some blessing in it. If you're into gardening at all, which I know a lot of us here at Central Baptist Church are, you may have heard of a planting technique that originates with the First Nation people of this country known as the Three Sisters. So the Three Sisters are three plants that in this technique are grown together. They support each other. They are corn, pole beans, and squash. Excuse me. So the idea is that the corn acts as a pole for the beans, and then the beans enrich the soil. They put nitrogen back into the soil, and the squash leaves act as a kind of weed block for the other two. Furthermore, says Anthony Walker from farmproject.org, the three sisters each provide an important component of a healthy diet. Corn provides carbohydrates, beans supply protein, and squash are rich in vitamins. Finally, since each of the three sisters is from a different crop family, they are susceptible to different diseases and pests, making the polycultural planting more resilient than monocultures often seen elsewhere. In other words, plants, like people, grow better where there is diversity because they can support each other's weaknesses and lacks. So today we're going to talk about what I am coming to see as the three sisters of life in the Spirit that we should be cultivating as we follow Jesus and as we try to communicate like he would with each other and the neighbors outside our doors. Right in between James's rant, we have noticed that James is a little ranty. And so we've already heard his rant in the beginning of chapter 3 about the need to control our tongues. And then we've also talked about his rant following this passage about how we will definitely fight with God and each other if we try to make ourselves the center of the universe. But right in between those two is this slightly calmer little bridge passage, James 3, 13 to 18. We read it along with the Tame the Tongue passage a few weeks ago, but we didn't really dig into it at that time, so we're going to try to do that today. Please turn there again with me. And because it's short, I will read it aloud. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. We've been kind of skipping around this book, covering some overarching big ideas that cover good communication, listening, communicating with God, watching what we say, focusing on God's being the center of the universe and our lives instead of us trying to be there ourselves. This week, and the final two, we will be looking at some subtler underlying ideas that support good communication. Today we're going to focus on the three sisters that support each other and nourish our souls and interactions with other people. And these are wisdom, humility, and peacemaking. James actually uses planting and farming imagery in this passage, appropriately enough. In verse 17, he talks about people with these three sisters, wisdom, humility, and peacemaking, in their lives, bearing good fruit. And he wraps up the section in verse 18 saying, peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. So now we know what kind of harvest we want. Righteousness. Righteousness, as we've mentioned at other times this year, means goodness, but it's the kind of goodness that comes from God's own goodness, reflecting God's holiness and justice in the way we treat people around us. The NIV Study Bible says, "The harvest, or fruit, that peacemakers produce is community-wide conduct that pleases God, unity in place of diversity, concern for others in place of selfishness." In the Beatitudes, Jesus himself specifically says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God." So if righteousness is the harvest, how do we cultivate that in ourselves? And what kinds of pests and blight and diseases might we need to guard against to make sure we get the good crop? "Who is wise and understanding among you?" James asks. And we remember that he introduced the topic of wisdom all the way back at the beginning of his letter. Does anyone remember what we learned about wisdom when we looked at it then? Yes, it's the one thing we can be sure we will receive from God if we ask for it and don't doubt. Here we see how we know someone has it. Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. James is almost talking in a circle. It's like he's saying, if you're really wise, you'll show it by your good works, which we remember are also a demonstration of our faith. So faith and wisdom go together too, even though James isn't naming that here. And your good works will be done humbly, and that's how we'll know you have wisdom, because humility is a result of wisdom. In our three sisters analogy, maybe wisdom is the corn. It's like the backbone of the whole operation, supporting everything else. And so maybe humility is the pole beans, because without God's wisdom, humility isn't even going to get off the ground. And the peace is the squash, the calm, underlying, underneath, protecting, covering squash. So let's talk about humility for a little bit, because it's kind of a tough concept to grasp, and it's even harder to achieve. It's one of those things that once you realize you have it, you don't have it anymore. I suspect one of the reasons James has discerned it comes from wisdom is because it is so slippery. It is so hard to hang on to. You really have to be a very wise person, a person with real God-given insight that then comes out in your life, to have the kind of perspective and lifestyle that is truly humble. It is nobody's default. Actually, our default is completely the opposite. I'm not sure that the kingdom of the world, where we all started out, even if we decided to follow Jesus when we were really little kids, has ever really cared about humility. At some points in history, there have been cultures where it's considered bad form to have too much self-confidence. But being self-effacing is not the same thing as being humble. And in sometimes in places like, for example, James's time and place, and our own time and place, it was seen as really vital to promote yourself. In the Roman Empire and in the American Empire, people were considered really noble if they loved themselves, could assert themselves, had a great self-concept. This is probably why James speaks so strongly against the rich and powerful in his letter, because everyone was expected to honor, or at least kowtow to, people with power, with resources, with loads of self-confidence. But James challenges that human value. He also names it differently. "But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts," he warns his readers in verse 14, "do not boast about it or deny the truth." Bitter envy and selfish ambition, those are the new names that James gives our self-confidence, are the weeds and the pests and the blight that will prevent us from harvesting righteousness. We might dress them up nicely, we might call them self-confidence or good self-esteem or goal setting, or even just plain ambition, which sounds better than selfish ambition. And we know people need some kind of ambition to move forward in life. These are things we are counseled to pursue in the kingdom of the world. They are the world's form of wisdom, and to an extent, they work. So, recently I've gone back to Twitter. I really don't like Twitter. I spend a lot of time on social media, and I've had a Twitter account before. Actually, I've had it this whole time, but I took a couple year break. I don't like it because everybody on there is angry about something, even angrier than on Facebook. They just have fewer words that they can post at a time about their anger. But I went back to Twitter because it's the one place you can have direct access, maybe, to famous or slightly famous people and have a slight chance of being acknowledged by them. Or if, say, you have a book you're trying to promote, you might have a chance at getting people to find out about it. If you can get famous people to notice you and notice your book, that's even better. Here's the thing, though. I believe the foundation of all social media, but maybe Twitter more than most sites, is the world's wisdom. Promote yourself and get ahead. This is the challenge for Christians on social media. This is something I wrestle with all the time. And we're not going to solve the problem today. I believe our church and the pilgrimage, for example, legitimately need to have a social media presence. That's why we have a Facebook page. That's why we have a website. It's why we have a podcast. Because these days, this is how people discover that we exist and how they learn what we're about. We already know that people walk by this church in real life and don't even know we're here. But we also need to be aware that these platforms are built on the world's wisdom, which at base is bitter envy and selfish ambition. We can see that this is true, can't we? Every social media platform is home to big, long, worldwide fights, which polarize communities even while these sites are supposed to be bringing people together. So if we think about it like that, we can agree with James when he says, such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. Basically, if we're seeking wisdom, but it comes out looking like attention-grabbing, self-promotion, and fighting, even if it gains us attention and promotion and financial benefits, it's not God's wisdom we've received. Just like our heated, untamed words earlier in this chapter, the source of this wisdom is not God. It's demonic. When envy and ambition are present and allowed to thrive, they will choke out our righteousness harvest and we'll end up reaping exactly the opposite. In verse 16, James says, for where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. Basically, when you boil it all down, we have communication problems, which lead to all the other problems. Forget about first world problems. These are just world problems. And they happen, James says, when we get our wisdoms mixed up, trying to bring kingdom of the world wisdom into the kingdom of God. You can tell the difference, James says, by humility. Did you know that true humility is originally and distinctly a Christian value? It is because Jesus is the only person who was ever humble by default and who shows us what humility actually looks like. Jesus had a right, more than anybody else, to be assertive and self-promoting. He is God, after all. He made literally everything, and he never sinned. But he came to earth to be one of us. Not only that, but he hung out with outcasts. He took on the role of a servant to his followers, even washing his disciples' feet. Isaiah 42, 1-3 says, here is my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one, in whom my soul delights. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. And Matthew quotes that same passage in his gospel, using it to refer to Jesus. A truly humble person is full of God's spirit, willingly takes the role of a servant, doesn't yell and shout to get attention or tell people off, but simply pursues justice, righteousness, for the people around them. But because we have a king like this, and because we still have a tendency, even when we acknowledge him as king, to let the weeds of world wisdom sneak into our gardens, most Christians have a mistaken view of what humility really is. We tend to think that if the wisdom of the world says to love ourselves by promoting ourselves, Humility, which is the wisdom of Jesus, must be the total opposite. It must be to nearly hate ourselves and diminish ourselves, or at least make it look like we do. This is why I believe James says, if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not, one, boast about it, or two, deny the truth. Don't be all proud of your envy and ambition like someone living under the authority of the world, like many of us on Twitter. But don't deny that you have these weeds in your life either. You don't get rid of weeds by denying they're there. In his famous novel, David Copperfield, Charles Dickens gives us a memorable character named Uriah Heep, a perfect picture of someone full of bitter envy and selfish ambition, who both boasts in them and denies the truth. Throughout the book, he repeatedly describes himself as humble. But Uriah Heep turns out to be one of the worst villains in any of Dickens' many novels, and maybe one of the worst ones in English literature. He downplays himself, he calls himself humble, but all the time he uses his humbleness to get ahead, to manipulate, to take advantage of people, and to steal what isn't his. Pastor Rick Warren says, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Uriah Heep thought of himself all the time. That's why his supposed humility was so envious and selfish and caused so much disorder and every evil practice. In the book, he gives some indication that he didn't get like this all on his own. It was the surroundings he grew up in that taught him to operate like this. Unfortunately, I think sometimes our churches become the very kind of environment in which that kind of self-effacing, downgrading humbleness is cultivated, because we haven't understood the humility of Jesus Christ. Much of the time in the church, in our well-intentioned attempts to be humble, we think we just need to think badly of ourselves and deflect all compliments, and soon it actually becomes a mark of credibility. Like, we think something's a little off if we compliment a person in church and they don't say something like, oh, it wasn't me, it was God. And it is right to attribute anything good we do to God's loving power at work in our lives. But most of the time when we say something like that, when we deflect a compliment in that way, something really weird happens. Even if the other person is expecting us to say that, it doesn't make that person that we're talking to think about God. It makes them think about us. And that's because we are actually thinking about us. We're thinking we're uncomfortable with the compliment. We're also thinking we're kind of pleased with the compliment. We might even maybe agree with the compliment. And if we have any sort of conscience about these things at all, we're also uncomfortable about how pleased we are and how much we agree with the compliment. Or maybe we really genuinely don't think we did a good job. Maybe we really genuinely don't like ourselves. Maybe we actually feel very insecure about who we are or the things that we do. So we say, oh no, it wasn't that good, or I'm not important, or so-and-so did a better job than I did, or I'll never be as good as whoever, or even, I'm a horrible person, I'll never be humble. Do we think this is what Jesus' humility was like? When Jesus made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, as it says in Philippians 2, it wasn't because he thought he was nothing. It wasn't because he had low self-esteem. He knew exactly who he was, God, the Son of God. And one day he's going to come in glory and we'll all see it. But he humbled himself because he was thinking about glorifying his Father and reconciling us. And now that is who we are. Jesus' humility was a completely realistic assessment of himself, which empowered him to focus on God and others. C.S. Lewis says, "Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you that, of course, he is nobody, like Uriah Heep, whom I'm pretty sure C.S. Lewis had in mind. Probably all you will think about him," Lewis goes on, is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud. And a biggish step, too. At least, nothing whatever can be done before it. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed. I think maybe James gives us the second step in chapter 1. Ask for wisdom. Unlike the wisdom of the world, which brings disorder and every evil practice, even into the church, God's wisdom is, first of all, pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial, and sincere. The weeds of bitter envy and selfish ambition are harmful to the church because they disguise themselves so well. It's easy to spiritualize them. It's easy to express them in God terms, and then use them to try to get our own way, just as we would do if we hadn't accepted Jesus as our King at all. I'm going to guess that the majority of miscommunications in churches stem from these two weeds, and from our boasting about them or denying that they're even in play. Next week we'll talk a little bit about what to do when there actually is disagreement going on in the church, but today James is encouraging us to cultivate the three sisters, which, as they grow, will help us to avoid discord in our church family in the first place. God's wisdom, James says, is pure, free of self-interest. And then the rest of this list in verse 17 is really just facets of humility. Humility like Jesus, which doesn't propel us into looking out for our own interests by downplaying ourselves, but instead causes us to long for truly peaceable interactions, motivating us to find ways to reconcile people with different opinions and experiences. Jesus' humility makes us consider other people's needs and wants and concerns. It makes us willing to submit our preferences to theirs. It extends mercy, not lashing out or punishing each other for poor choices or behavior as we hold each other accountable, because we do need to hold each other accountable. The result of our communication together are then good fruit. Because we have considered each other and communicated faithfully and clearly, we haven't picked favorites and we haven't masked our intentions or been hypocritical, but we have been truthful and sincere. When we ask God for his wisdom, we will get it, which will lead us into the humility of Jesus as we discover over time just how unwise self-absorption really is. And when we are humble like Jesus, presumably, and I say presumably because I haven't gotten here yet either, but I believe this is what James is sharing, and I believe he's a reliable witness inspired by God's Holy Spirit. Presumably, this humility of Jesus leads us to the third sister, peace. Peace-loving and peacemaking. When you are wise enough to be humble, and you are humble enough not to be worried about your own needs or making yourself look bad or good, humble enough not to need to please people at any cost, humble enough not to think it's up to you to solve all the problems in the church or in the family or in the world, and humble enough to truly consider the other person before you and what they really need, you will be at peace. You know why? Because the bitter envy and selfish ambition that have been plaguing you, that have been plaguing me, that caused discord between us, but also inside us, are gone. When we are at peace within ourselves, which can only occur as we focus on and spend time with God, and through him focus on and spend time with other people, we will be able to make peace too. We will be peacemakers who sow in peace, and we will reap a harvest of righteousness. Thanks be to God.